Welcome to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Later in the show, we'll learn about a town hall meeting held in Ames this week, geared toward welcoming refugees in the community. We'll also hear about a delegation of visitors from Asian countries with fledgling democracies such as Afghanistan and Mongolia. As part of their visit to Ames, these grassroots leaders stopped in at the station here at Douglas Avenue because, well, where better to experience democracy than at a community radio station? Speaking of democracy and the First Amendment rights of assembly and petition, in a moment we will hear about the People's Climate March at the Des Moines Capitol Building this coming Saturday, an event that will correspond to the national event in Washington, D.C. But first, I'd like to remind our listeners that KHOY is still seeking pledges to help us reach our $15,000 matching grant, the goal of our spring fund drive. If you like what you hear on this station and recognize, as I'm sure you do, that this kind of broadcasting by volunteer reporters collecting uncensored voices from our community is only available on community radio, please support us so that we can continue to fulfill our mission. The best way to do that is to go online now at khoyfm.org and press the Donate Now button. Or text us with the amount you would like to give at 515-200-7758. That's 515-200-7758. Just text us the amount you want to give and the rest will be clear as mud or even clearer. Any amount you can give will help, but we are seeking members at the memberships at the $55, $100, and $250 levels. Won't you put your support behind keeping community voices on the air? Well, KHOY's reporting on the Climate Justice Unity March in Iowa began on Wednesday's Local Talk with Susan Franzen reporting on the origins of the march, a statewide march starting on Earth Day last Saturday at Little Creek Camp in Williamsburg, Iowa. A contingent of Iowans who have been focused on climate change and especially on stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline are marching a route of 85 miles this week to get to the state capitol by Saturday, this coming Saturday at 1 p.m., when the People's Climate March event will be held. Last night, Susan Franzen met up with this crew again, where they spent the night at Prairie City Community Center. And she sent us three brief interviews. The first is from Shelley Buffalo, who will be a speaker at the rally on Saturday. She lives on the Meskwaki settlement, but spent a lot of time at Standing Rock Camp up in North Dakota. She explains how the spirit of this Ocheti Sakowin camp, as it's called, inspired the formation of the Little Creek Camp in Williamsburg. This camp was formed after the state and federal law enforcement under the Trump administration forced the evacuation of the North Dakota camp.
The people who are at the heart of this camp are passionate about clean, not just water, you know, but air and land, about sustainability, about walking and behaving and living in a prayerful and respectful way, not only towards the land, but especially about each other. And that's bringing the spirit of Ocheti back home, because in the community in Ocheti, people took care of each other. If you need anything, somebody would find what you needed. And if, you know, there are many people that went there and were able to take direct action to resist the pipeline, and there were others that went there that simply needed healing. For example, myself, I experienced a lot of healing there, although it was difficult to be there at the same time. It was traumatizing because of the, you know, it was truly a war zone, make no mistake, but it was very healing because of the constant prayer and the type of community. And so, once again, that's the inspiration for Little Creek.
And Little Creek Camp, again, is where this march, this 85-mile march, started on Earth Day. It'll get to the state capitol on Saturday. Heather Pearson is another marcher who will tell her story at the People's March in Des Moines and the rally. In this clip, she explains the defense that she's going to test in her upcoming trial at the Calhoun County Courthouse regarding her protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Well, we were at Shirley Gurgit's farm. We had Farmers Defense Camp, and we were standing up for private property rights, for clean water, for clean soil, and for climate justice. So that's what we were there for. Shirley was not for the pipeline. She was against the pipeline. They used eminent domain and forced it through her property, through her family farm. Without her permission, she had not even had her day in court yet regarding this eminent domain issue, and they were already doing construction. So we went to stand in solidarity. You see, I'm an Iowa landowner as well. And that pipe going through Shirley's property just felt like it would be if it were going through my own property. It appalls me that my elected representatives are so willing to sell out our private property rights to a private corporation for an export pipeline. It just doesn't make sense to me. So we went to stand in solidarity. Now, Shirley gave us written permission to be on her property. We had an affidavit that she signed giving us permission, calling us her invitees. She had signs posted saying that Dakota Access did not have her permission to be on her property. So when I stepped on that part of the property that was stolen by eminent domain, that's when the sheriff said that I was trespassing. Now, the way that the law is worded in Iowa, it says trespassing without justification. And the thing is we had justification. So our justification, other than the fact that we had the permission from the landowner to be there in the first place, I also had the 2015 Iowa climate statement, which I handed to the sheriff as he was arresting me. And I said, "Sheriff, this is my justification for being on this property." So that's the case that we're going to try in court. There, it's State of Iowa versus Heather Pearson. They keep moving the date on us, so we're still trying to nail that down. But what we would like to prove in court is that climate change is indeed justification to step onto a fossil fuel easement.
Now, where did you get this 2015 statement?
Well, every year Iowa comes out with a climate statement, and this one in 2015 happened to be signed by 188 professors from around Iowa. So it's all from in-state, and our climate scientists that are from Iowa, and basically it says that, yes, climate change is real, and we are adding to the problem, we are exacerbating it, we are the cause of man-made climate change, and there are many steps that we need to take in order to stop it. And one of those steps is to leave the rest of the oil in the ground. We do not need new fossil fuel infrastructure, especially fossil fuel infrastructure that's only purpose is to ship that to the foreign export market. So why should Iowans have to risk their soil, their water, their private property rights, and the climate just so a private corporation can make more money selling their oil to the export market?
And that was Heather Pearson, a member of the Climate Justice Unity March. It's heading across Iowa and going to end up at the State House on Saturday for the rally. Thanks so much to our tireless reporter, Susan Franzen, who went the extra mile to meet these folks where they were spending the night. Well, on the phone, we have one of the organizers of Saturday's event, David Osterberg. David is a former Iowa legislator. He is the founder of the Iowa Policy Project and a professor of occupational and environmental health at the University of Iowa. Welcome, David.
Hey, hi, Greta.
And we just heard the voices of a couple people who are marching to Des Moines from Williamsburg. I understand you also participated in that hike.
I was there for the first couple of days, the fair weather part.
I see. Got a little cooler, and the weather seems to be continuing downhill, unfortunately. You heard the part about the 2015 climate statement. I was just wondering when I heard that whether you were among the professors who signed that.
I was indeed, and I've been I've worked on pretty directly on that the last couple of years. And again, it's put together by a couple of people, one at the University of Iowa and one at Drake, and they go out and a small group of us write a statement, and then and work because the hardest thing, of course, is to write something with only one page by anybody in academia. But we write that and then send it out for more comments, and then send it out when it's final and see who will sign it. And as Heather said, there were 188 people. And they are at all kind. They're at Iowa State University. I realize I'm talking in Ames right now.
Mm-hmm.
Also at the University of Iowa, as you'd expect, the research institutions. But it's also Drake and Cornell College and Kirkwood Community College and DMAC and all over the state. So you will find somebody that may be your neighbor who has signed that statement, and that's the point. Climate change is real.
Well, we've heard a bit about the pipeline and its role in climate change. How else does the policy that we set here in Iowa play a role in this larger problem, the global problem? And its solutions, yeah.
Yeah, we were one of the first places to do something called a renewable portfolio standard, which requires our electric utilities to try alternatives to coal and natural gas. And we passed that early on in 1983. The utilities were not amused. They fought it and fought it and fought it, and finally reluctantly started putting up wind turbines. And with that tiny poor requirement on them, it was 2% of their generation capacity. They've now moved on, so 36% of what is generated in the state comes from wind. It's once they tried it, they figured it would work pretty well, but you had to make them try it, and that's the role of government, I think, is to make people do what's good for the society as a whole, but may not be good for every single industry in it. But again, once they figured it out, and we have to give credit to MidAmerican Energy because they are the one entity in this state that has really embraced wind, they moving to wind means that we are putting out much less carbon dioxide in the way we produce electricity.
Oh, that's a great story. It seems like we might have had some reversals, though, on the policy horizon recently.
Well, we might have. We don't know yet. But certainly the getting rid of the Leopold Center certainly says the state oughtn't to be involved in sustainability and making the environment better. When the legislature did that, and it's not over. Anybody listening, please write the governor to try to save Leopold, because it is that fits in with things like more wind power to say that this state can be a big part of confronting climate change. And farmers, changing tillage to no-till, putting down more cover crops, those things which help water quality also help climate.
That's right. The carbon sequestration is the term of choice, I think.
That's the term of choice, and that really, there's, in fact, the climate statement of 2000, Heather talked about the climate statement of 2015. There was also one in 2016, and the latest one talked precisely about farming for carbon.
Well, you're going to emcee this event on Saturday, the People's Climate March in Des Moines. Can you tell us which speakers you're looking forward to the most?
Well, you just talked to Heather.
Okay.
She's got to be one of them.
Right.
But assuming that the marchers get there on time, and we hope they get there on time, the first person will be Shelley Buffalo, and who's the Meskwaki woman.
We also aired her earlier.
Oh, you
in the
did?
Show. Yep.
Well,
we got
very,
you.
Both these people, we just heard Heather, but a very articulate woman, Shelley.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she will talk about a Native American perspective on climate change. And we will have Tim Dwight. We always try to have Tim Dwight, who is a football hero at Iowa. in Iowa State at Iowa, went on to the NFL, and now has a company that puts up solar. He's really a great speaker. So Tim will talk about the need to support solar. I get to speak besides emceeing. We have an Episcopal priest at St. Paul's in Grinnell. That's Wendy Abramson. And we have one legislator only. This is going to be not heavily legislator-ish, and that's Akko Abdul Samad. And we have a songwriter and song singer who's going to be singing, D'Artagnan Brown. A young woman, and I don't know much about her, Ellery McAllister. All I know is she's 15 years old. I don't know which high school she's from. We met briefly on the phone, so I haven't met most of these people. And Patty Edwardson, we certainly need to have a farmer.
She's a friend of KHOI,
for sure. Talked about the sequestration of carbon.
Yep.
And we'll talk about Michael Yonadaman, and that's a person, Michel Yonadaman, and I don't know much about him except he is a Syrian refugee, and we'll talk about how much climate change helped cause this disaster, this political disaster in his former country. And then we finish up with Heather, and that's the talk. And if it's going to rain, we're certainly going to try to make people speak for 3 minutes only. We want to have speakers, and then we want to have a little marching, and then we don't want to get that wet.
Okay, and have you made your sign yet?
I've not made a sign, no. Good point. I think there will be sign-making materials when you get to the Capitol tomorrow. All of this starts at 1 p.m., but a bit before you could do things like create a sign, and there will be tables from various groups around also.
Sounds great.
There are lots and lots of sponsors. I'm supposed to read a list of sponsors, but it goes on for two pages.
Oh.
But lots of groups are involved in this. Climate change is something we all have to be part of.
Well, sounds like a wonderful event. I plan to go rain or shine, and I'll have to dig out my umbrella just in case.
Bring your umbrella. That's right. And then it'll all be fine.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, David. See
you
tomorrow.
Greta. Okay.
David Osterberg from University of Iowa, as well as the Iowa Policy Project. Well, last Monday, KHOI received special and unusual visitors, delegates from Middle Asia, the Caucasus, Afghanistan, and Mongolia came to our radio station, and they were hosted by members of Friendship Force International, a nonprofit cultural organization for developing global understanding between people. KHOI's station manager, Ursula Rudenberg, met with the delegates and was able to interview them. We wanted to share the descriptions they gave of their countries with you. Here is Ursula's report on the visit.
This is Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm with Cheryl Benson, an Ames resident. Cheryl contacted me last week about bringing a group of foreign delegates to KHOI. They were Open World Rumsfeld Delegate Fellows, and they included government employees and media people from Afghanistan, Mongolia, Georgia, and Armenia. Of course, everybody still wants to know, how did these folks end up in Ames, Iowa, and how did they end up at KHOI? I've asked Cheryl to explain.
There are three organizations involved in helping us host the delegates that came here. The first is the Rumsfeld Foundation.
Started by Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense.
Exactly. This particular program was started in 2008, so it would have been after his term. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that during his official capacity, he did go to Central Asia, the Caucasus, Afghanistan, and Mongolia, and met some amazing people, and realized that it was a key part of our world. There was a lot going on over there, to say the least. The program is 6 weeks long, and what they do is they meet with top policymakers, public officials, business leaders, etc., at Washington, D.C. The purpose is to foster better understanding and stronger relations between the United States and the countries of the region. And then there's a Open World Leadership Center, which is actually an independent government agency of our Congress. Mm-hmm. The open world aspect really is to have the field fellows move outside of Washington, D.C. to other parts of our country. And those two organizations work together, and they ended up in Ames through Friendship Force International.
And now, who is Friendship Force International?
Friendship Force is a nonprofit cultural organization that promotes understanding, cultural education, and citizen diplomacy through homestays or journeys. So travel from one country to another or other parts of our own country.
We have a Friendship Force organization here in Central Iowa.
Absolutely.
Is it in Ames or where is it?
It's in Ames. Mm-hmm. Roger Bertelson is our co-president. So Friendship Force International contacted Friendship Force Central Iowa and asked if we were interested in hosting a group. We said yes. There were 6 that came here, and there were 7 that went to Hartford, Connecticut. So I don't know what their experience was mm-hmm. like, but those were the 2 locations that Open World chose for this particular group.
That's kind of an honor to be one of 2 locations representing the United States.
We were thrilled. Uh-huh. We were very thrilled, yes. Yeah. It was a wonderful experience for all of us. The group that came here was focused primarily on accountable governance.
And these people were all employees of their governments on some level?
Yes, except for one. One was employed with the media.
Okay, so that explains how they got here to Ames. And then how did they end up here at KHOI?
There was a group of 5 of us from Friendship Force Central Iowa that were the planning team. We wanted to have people in our community to hear from the people that were coming to visit us, the delegates, the fellows. So we asked KHOI if we could come and visit. Community radio was a great way to do that.
So let's listen to what the delegates said.
My name is Paramdash, and I'm from Mongolia. I work for a media group in Mongolia, and I'm in charge of a news TV channel in operation for 21 years, which was actually opened in cooperation with the American group called the Hmong Foundation. In the early 1990s, when Mongolia opened up to the world, and we embarked on a road for democracy and market economy, and some of the leaders of Democratic Party believed that opening a news TV was a good thing and to introduce the democratic values. And then they seeked some assistance from America, and they got trainings and assistance from CNN for about 5-6 years, and we had also assistance from Fox News.
CNN and Fox News responded?
Yes, that's right.
Are you protected by a Mongolian constitution as media? You have the equivalent of a First Amendment?
Yes, we have equivalent of First Amendment. We are trying to develop this investigative journalism. We have this big sensation going on related to offshore accounts because of the Panama Papers, and then we try to dig.
Mongolia is located both near Russia and China, but Mongolia has been independent from both.
Yeah, we have 2 neighbors. Both of them are great big nations in terms of territory, in terms of power.
Describe Mongolia.
Mongolia is known for Genghis Khan, who was a great leader. He united the different tribes of Mongolia in 1206.
Genghis Khan.
And then he tried to reach to half of Poland, half of Hungary, and all of China and all of Russia. We became independent in 1911 from the Manchu dynasty, which occupied all China and Mongolia. And then in 1921, we became a second communist country because of Soviet intervention. And then in 1990s, we became Democratic Mongolia. And some people say that Mongolia is a democratic island sandwiched between 2 big neighbors who are not often democratic.
Uh-huh. What was different about the new initiative of democracy?
In the previous independence movement in 1911, we wanted to follow the models of Switzerland or France and Germany. But because of the Soviet domination, we couldn't make our own choice. And this time we really made our choice. And then we decided to follow the British model, where you have parliamentary democracy. In parliament, you have many people who will make decisions and who cannot be easily dominated by either powers.
How does a country like that make a transition into a democracy?
In 1989, we had the first demonstrations against communist rule, and Soviet Union withdrew their troops from Mongolia, and then we felt sudden breath of freedom, and Mongolia decided to move forward.
Were people united in this idea, or were there people that felt, no, we don't want to do this?
The dominating climate was people were united in this change, and the moderates dominated in the protest movements, and they decided to make the transition peaceful. We are proud that we made it without any bloodshed.
It's very interesting to hear you describe what's happening in Mongolia. Do you have community radio in Mongolia? Do you know?
Yes, we have community radios. And I was traveling to one of the Western IMAX, and they had around 1,000 herder families, and they had a community radio aired on the street. And the social media is also playing a bigger and bigger role. And I came to know about KHOI radio and then how they're engaging their community at a grassroots level. It's such an inspiring case. My impression is that democracy is not for parliamentarians or political parties or top-down, you know, agenda. It's the community and the people themselves. They have to care for democracy and they have to contribute to it. And I'm impressed by the American citizens, they for this community, radios and this communication at the grassroots level.
You live in a rural or an urban area?
I live in a city. It's Ulaanbaatar. This is capital city, 1.2 million, which is equal to all the Facebook accounts of Mongolians.
And does it look like an American city? Or?
I would say it's quite different from American city because we had a lot of Soviet time architecture. And recently we have a lot of Hong Kong style of skyscrapers and tall buildings.
So it's also a very modern city?
Yes. And we have also the traditional old round-shaped felt houses that the nomads use.
Hello, my name is Edward Abrahamian, and I'm from Armenia. I am a co-founder of the Council for Cooperation with NATO based in Yerevan. Simultaneously, I'm conducting my PhD research, and the area of my professional expertise is Eastern European security, security in the South Caucasus and the Black Sea. Armenia is an emerging democracy. It's a parliamentary democracy. Armenia declared its pro-Western part since 1991-1992, once it regained its independence. But it found itself somewhat isolated from the regional processes, sandwiched between Azerbaijan, which is an adversary over the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute, and Turkey, the NATO country which closed border with Armenia.
You have a very clear identity of your own.
We have our clear identity. We have a roughly 3,000 old history of statehood and rich history and culture. But because Armenia experienced a U-turn from the European integration, we are in profound perplexity in how to identify the political path for development of the country and the society. Armenia is highly dependent on Russia in terms of energy and security. In 2014, Armenia became more exposed because of Russia's attempt to impose economic and security framework alternatives to the West. On the other hand, Armenia experienced difficulties in its economy because of that U-turn. So this is a very complex situation for the country, and it needs to overcome it as soon as it is possible.
What is the highest priority right now for Armenia in terms of addressing this dangerous situation?
To pursue balanced foreign policy, a good relationship with all neighbors as much as it is possible, and balanced and deep relationship with Russia and the West, which is very hard to pursue at the moment because of the mounting standoff between these two poles.
I can see both in the tone of your voice and your whole demeanor, it's an extremely serious situation at this time.
Yeah, because of the occupation of Crimea initiated by Russia, the security threats and challenges became more real and grave for the countries surrounded the Black Sea region since 2014. The cooperation with the United States is imperative. I hope this is the region where the United States is able to make a difference. The growing stance of the United States is of paramount importance for the neighbors of Russia. In order to boost the security and in order to enhance the defensibility of the countries.
There's a lot at stake.
Yeah.
I am Tengiz Khaladze. I am from Georgia. It's a country near the Black Sea. I work in government.
Could you give us a little bit of sense of what is happening in Georgia?
Regrettably, we were a part of Soviet Union, suffering from the occupation. But these 25 years, we are independent. And Georgia is the democracy of reforms into the region. We are presidential republic, it's a multicultural democracy. We have free media. And we have separation of power like the United States. Our soldiers were together in Afghanistan. Georgia is a partner of the United States. and I'm really happy. We enjoy bipartisan support from United States.
And is there concern?
Concern about Russia, it always exists in our region because what we're witnessing, and not just in Georgia, but in all neighboring countries of Russia, there is really very big tension. So Georgia, Ukraine, everywhere you can find that Russia is engaged. And of course, not just we, but all European security is suffering. That's why it's necessary to strengthen our cooperation and strengthen our ties.
And what do you do in that?
We try to develop cooperation projects. We'll engage many countries. Probably are aware about the Silk Road project.
What is the Silk Road project?
Transportation routes which will link east and west, like railway transportation, new road constructions.
Are you optimistic about democracy developing further in Georgia? It sounds like that's a lot of what you're doing.
Pretty sure. And 90% of Georgian population support EU integration and 80% supports NATO integration. So we are keen in our strategic choice.
So you're saying you're optimistic because you feel this is what people want.
Yeah, this is the public demand and, of course, government follow.
I'm Farishta Sahi. Currently, I'm an independent consultant doing a lot of work on human rights and democracy in Afghanistan. I work with women rights NGOs, promoting women inclusion in peace process, women political participation, and also advocating for economic independence of women.
Women are going to school now in Afghanistan?
Yes, after the collapse of Taliban and with the intervention of United States and our other allies and friends, fortunately, Afghan women and girls are going to schools, and they are making very good progress in different sectors.
I'm Basir Yusufi, and I'm from Afghanistan. I work at the Ministry of Interior. Our department is responsible for coordinating our relations with different partners that we have, different countries, the U.S., NATO, and other in the country. What we do is make sure that the assistance which is provided are used to achieve the goal of a more effective, credible, and honest police forces.
It's a complex situation right now for you.
Yes, it is actually. We have been facing the problem of terrorism for a long time now. At the same time, the police forces have to focus on fighting crimes. At the same time, fighting terrorism, which is a very difficult thing to do. We have been facing this problem for a long time. Taliban have been fighting in Afghanistan and doing all sorts of horrible things. And more recently, there have been the presence of ISIS in Afghanistan, which is also a serious threat to the country, but also to the region.
You are clearly isolating them as not part of the mainstream of Afghanistan.
I refer to the Taliban as terrorist groups because that's what they are doing in Afghanistan. They are killing security forces. They are indiscriminately attacking schools, mosques, and markets, gatherings of the people. Taliban, unfortunately, ran the country for 4 to 5 years, depending on different parts of the country, but that was one of the darkest periods of our history. If we compare this period to the time of the Taliban, there is a complete change.
Explain.
During the Taliban, there was only boys who went to school, and the total number was not more than 1 million in total. But now there are 8 to 9 million students going to school, about 40% are young girls. There is tens of media outlets, TV channels, radios, and so on, which didn't exist at the time of the Taliban at all. They banned all the TV networks. They had only one radio that was their own and propagating terrorism.
Do you think community radio is possible in Afghanistan?
Actually, there are tens of them now in Afghanistan trying to communicate with the community, accountability issues, but also to have a broader broadcasting of what different people want and what different people say.
You're obviously young enough to have grown up with all of this transitions happening in your country. You grew up during a time of war in your country. You probably even grew up during a time of the Taliban in your country. What is this like for you?
I think the worst time that I have experienced was the time of the Taliban. They undermined all the government institutions, our cultural heritage. As you know, they destroyed the Bamiyan sculptures. That was the biggest sculptures in the world. They also destroyed a lot of the local traditions and local institutions, all bringing on their own interpretation of religion and culture and everything. We have a very old culture, about 5,000 years. Afghanistan is very famous for its hospitality, for its poetry, for it is some of the greatest scholars, poets. So it's not just about terrorism that unfortunately we have been facing in the past few years, but it is a lot more than that. We have a very rich literature. We have many local languages and traditions.
We lived in a dark period during Taliban, but I think it's also important to know that before Taliban, Afghanistan was an open society. It was not a closed society. And now we are reinstating that situation. We are restoring that situation. It has opened a new chapter for all Afghan women. So the whole inclusion of women in the political spectrum, in the economic spectrum of life, that's very uplifting. And Afghan women remains highly thankful, especially to the U.S. women organizations and individual women who extended a great deal of support. And we had several organizations that spoke very vocal during Taliban regime, like Feminist Majority in D.C., and they were our voice.
These people made a difference.
Yes, women rights advocates in the United States and around the world were our voice during those dark periods. And we remain thankful to them, and we count on their support for further help and for further projects that can really bring economic independence and that can educate more Afghan women and that can ensure women participation in the political life of our country.
Are you optimistic?
Yes, I think Afghans have shown during all these periods of civil war and invasions that we are resilient people. We just need the right kind of support. We don't want Afghanistan to be a safe haven for all the terrorist groups. We need the United States and our NATO allies and other partners to stay active with us in fighting war on terror.
I very much like that I am serving my country, working for its improvement. I was here in the United States. I was a Fulbrighter here, but I went back to contribute to rebuilding and establishing peace to my country. And so what I would like to say here, first of all, to the American people, that we thank them for the continuous support and assistance that have provided, and also for their support in the fight against terrorism, which is a security threat not only to Afghanistan, but also to the U.S. and the whole world. I'm optimistic. We now have a democratic government, which is elected by the people. We have the parliament. We have a very strong civil society. We have a very strong media, and millions of people are going to school. I'm optimistic. We have no choice. We have to continue to work for improvement. The good thing is that people have experienced the time of the Taliban. A lot of time when extremists want to take power, they promise very fancy things to the people, and in that way they can win over some of them. But in our case, in Afghanistan, we have experienced the Taliban, and they were the worst, that they are no longer an option. So there is very little public support, and with the support of the people, I'm very hopeful and optimistic.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Ursula Rudenberg for Local Talk, and you've been hearing from Open World Rumsfeld Delegates Fellows who were visiting Ames from the countries of Afghanistan, Mongolia, Armenia, and Georgia. They were brought to KHOI by Central Iowa's Friendship Force. Cheryl Benson of Ames introduced them to us.
Is there a website for Friendship Force?
There is a website for the Friendship Force International, mm-hmm. and from that you can look at clubs all over the world, friendshipforceinternational.org.
Friendshipforceinternational.org. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I want to thank KHOI for this opportunity to have a broader reach than we were able to one-on-one throughout the community.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And thanks also to Ursula Rudenberg for that report. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. It sure says a lot that our little radio station in downtown Ames was the focus of attention of these international dignitaries. KHOI Community Radio is not just a cultural gem, it's a lodestone for democracy. And so now is the time to remind you that we are still seeking pledges to meet our $15,000 challenge grant. And those funds are needed to keep this place humming as a model of what can happen when common people's voices are amplified and their intelligence is heard. Go to khoifm.org and press the Donate Now button, or text us at 515-200-7758 with the amount of money you would like to donate and follow the simple instructions. Well, I've been joined in the studio by Diane Burt, who is stepping in for our regular Ames Progressive Alliance correspondent in Kinzel, who is not able to be here today on this last Friday of the month. Well, I suppose we can continue this thread of international visitors, Diane, with the Ames Progressive Alliance's co-sponsorship of the recent town hall meeting called Welcoming Refugees.
Yes. Actually, the One World delegates attended our conference as a or as our town hall meeting as a way to see democracy in action here in central Iowa. We had more than 200 participants at the town hall meeting. It was fantastic. We had about an hour of comments. Well, first we had a very, I think, moving film of Yassim, a Syrian who started a falafel house, and how he struggled but overcame those struggles to get himself established.
A falafel house in the U.S.?
In the U.S., yes. Uh-huh. I think it was in Tennessee. And then we had comments from six panelists. Carly Ross was one who spoke with us about what it takes to settle refugees in central Iowa. She is the director of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants in Des Moines. And she did note that there will be two families settled in Ames with relatives in the next few months. So we will have some refugees settled here.
And are they from Syria or from somewhere else?
No, Somalia.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And anyway, after the hour of comments by panelists, then we had an hour of questions from the audience. A lot of questions related to, you know, what can we do to help as individuals? What types of support is given to refugee families when they come? Then there were questions about, issues, should we be concerned about refugees causing violence in our society? And I think a very good point was made that, the greatest risks we have aren't associated with refugees. They're kind of our homegrown people that that incite violence. Just a broad mix of people. It was a very diverse group, and I think that the team that put the program together, the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance, was very pleased with the outcome and feel that this did move Ames in a direction to help us prepare for settling refugees here. Following the meeting and kind of the correspondence that we had amongst the members of the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance, John Pleasance, one of our members with the Ames Jewish congregation, made a very strong and, I think, moving comment. And if you don't mind, it's very brief. I'll read it here.
Yeah.
He said, "It's ironic that the town hall meeting was in the same room where on the previous evening there was an activity associated with Holocaust Remembrance Day. The project involved researching local Iowa newspapers from the 1930s and 40s to determine what people could have known about what was happening to the Jews of Europe. The information was there, although sometimes buried in the back pages. People knew that things were bad and that Jews were desperate to get out of Germany and elsewhere. Yet the response of our government, which reflected the feelings of the populace, was to turn refugees away and not even fill already existing quotas. The lack of response was a result of widespread anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S., along with isolationism, as demonstrated by the America First Committee," the original first use of that term. Mm. Today, we have a similar situation with anti-Muslim sentiment in a government that is proclaiming America first and reducing the number of refugees admitted. We did not fulfill our moral obligation to help refugees in the 1930s and 40s. We have a similar moral obligation today, both on general humanitarian and grounds, and also because our actions and inactions in the Middle East have contributed to the refugee crisis. Let's hope that history isn't repeated. And again, that was John Pleasant's comment with the Ames Jewish Congregation.
Very worthwhile listening to. So what are there opportunities for the Ames community to speak out and say, yes, we'd like to receive, welcome refugees? Is there an application process?
There will be an opportunity for Ames through the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants for us to apply. But right now, with the reduced number of refugees being admitted, it's been decided to put off application. The refugees that will be settled here will be supported through Des Moines, the refugees that I mentioned, that a couple families. The hope is that there will be a push at the national level, and you know, I encourage everyone to contact their representatives in Congress and at the state level to encourage them to boost our refugee quotas back up and to support funding for refugee resettlement. So one of the things we did at the symposium was encourage letter writing and postcard writing to let people know that we want to help with the refugee crisis. It is a huge problem. We have probably more refugees looking for help than we've ever had before in the world. Ames is a community that has a lot of resources, and we certainly can help in this.
Uh-huh. And it strikes me that the more refugees that can be brought into the United States, the less burden that places on the immediately adjacent states. The presence of just huge numbers of refugees has to destabilize some of those government or some of those, you know, communities, societies, and you know, add to some of the problems that that are immediately in that area.
Yes, and the countries that are taking and helping the vast majority of the refugees in the Middle East don't have the resources that to help, and they don't have the resources that we have here.
Right.
And another point that was made by some of our participants was that the refugees really contribute to the workforce. These are hardworking people that really strive to succeed.
Yeah.
They're not coming over here for a handout.
Right. And some of them have a great deal of skill
in
particular areas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they might get a starting level job at that, but their children will certainly be shining stars of the community in
their
schools.
And we certainly have examples, all over the United States of how refugees who have then become immigrants, have contributed to our society.
Okay, well, that sounds hopeful. I mean, it's a hopeful thing that our community got together in such force, 200 mm-hmm. strong, to say that this is a priority.
Right.
So hopefully that follow-through can happen with postcards.
Right. And the other thing is we welcome more people to join our Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. We have about 80 members at the present time. About a third of those are, quote, non-affiliated. So although when we named the group, we were largely interfaith, we have gone beyond that, although we've kept that name. We have 25 churches, synagogue, the Jewish community that are represented. We have five non-government and NGO-type social action groups that are also represented in our membership. And we welcome more people. We also are kind of starting or have a list of different skills that people are willing to provide to help language skills or tutoring or, you know, even helping with housing. There's all kinds of things that are going to be needed when we're resettling refugees.
Okay, well, and how do they connect with you?
Send me an email.
Diane Burt, dbert at?
dbert.ames@gmail.com. Okay.
And that's B-I-R-T, D-B-I-R-T,
yes. Right.
ames@gmail.com.
Right.
Okay, and you are also going to tell us about the Ames Progressive Alliance Implicit Bias Workshop next week.
Yes, yes. The Implicit Bias Workshop came out of the, I'm sure last November you remember the Inclusive Ames event, and Ames Progressive Alliance put that together, and then we had a number of subcommittees that came out. You probably had some discussion of those in your earlier discussions, and one developed the implicit bias or worked on the implicit bias workshop. It will be held next Wednesday, May 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ames Public Library. And Ames Progressive Alliance is partnering with the Ames chapter of the NAACP, Black Lives Matter, Iowa, the City of Ames Human Relations Commission, and the Ames Public Library to offer the workshop. Implicit bias, if you haven't heard that term before, refers to the attitudes and stereotypes that influence how we interact with other people. It may not, we generally aren't aware of our implicit bias. It's something that's kind of below the surface, and it helps, this workshop is to help us identify them and help us, if need be, correct them, help us understand. We all have biases. I mean, that's part of being human. And when your biases, though, are hurting your interactions with people and hurting those people, then that's a big problem. We are thrilled that we have Dr. Stephen Biggs presenting the workshop. He's a professor in the Philosophy and Religious Studies Department at Iowa State.
Okay.
So you are welcome to come. We hope that we'll have as large of a group there as we had this last week.
All right. So that's Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., a workshop on implicit bias, kind of helping you look inside yourself and think about those snap judgments you might make before really considering everything and how that affects relationships.
That's right.
Okay. Great work that our community is doing to help us be a better place. Thank you so much, Diane.
Well, we have one other thing. We'd like you to hold the date, July 9th. We are in the early stages of organizing a Ames Progressive Alliance picnic. We'll be involving a lot of our partner organizations. So if you're with an organization that has partnered with us, expect to hear from us. But the point now is just to hold the date.
Okay. That sounds like the weekend after July 4th.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
July 9th. Thank you so much, Diane Burt, Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance, wearing a second hat for the Ames Progressive Alliance.
Yes. Well, thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We started the show with voices from the Climate Justice Unity March across Iowa. These folks are marching from Little Creek Camp at Williamsburg, Iowa, to the state capitol, where the People's Climate March will be held this Saturday at 1 p.m. in conjunction with the national event. Those voices were Shelley Buffalo and Heather Pearson. Thanks to Susan Franzen for that report. We also spoke with David Osterberg about the march. He will be the MC. Local Talk reporter and station manager Ursula Rudenberg then brought us Cheryl Binzen from Friendship Force International. She brought an international delegation to KHOI studios this past Monday. It gives one pause to consider how important a democratic tool grassroots radio can be. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.